This is chapter 11, the master of the work, page 243 in the new edition of the Synthesis of Yoga.
And reading order, do you have a proposition, Marco?
What I see on my screen is Radhika first, then me, then Andrea, then Geoffrey, you, and then John Robert. But it's just the clock and the...
I think the order is different for each person.
Yeah. So one person has to choose it, is what.
But you can move around the pictures on your screen so that you have the right order if you want to.
And are you comfortable to start, Radhika?
Yeah, sure, I can start.
Good.
We're not doing a meditation in the beginning. I thought we're supposed to do.
Yes, we will do one. John Robert, do you have your bell?
I can get it. It's just a second here.
I tried to. Decent bell never worked with my microphone. Perhaps we should see
how... Well, John Robert seems to work, so and I'd rather a physical bell than a virtual one. I have a virtual one, but I'd prefer the physical one. So
shall I start now?
Yes, you can start.
Okay, chapter 11, the master of the work. The master and mover of our works is the one, the universal and supreme, the eternal and infinite. He is the transcendent unknown or unknowable absolute, the unexpressed and unmanifested ineffable above us. But he is also the self of all beings, the master of all worlds, transcending all worlds, the light and the guide, the all beautiful and all blissful, the beloved and the lover. He is the cosmic spirit and all creating energy around us. He is the immanent within us. All that is he, and he is the more than all that is, and we ourselves, though we know it not, are being of his being, force of his force. Conscious with a consciousness derived from his. Even our mortal existence is made out of his substance. And there is an immortal within us that is a spark of the light and bliss that are forever. No matter whether by knowledge, works, love, or any other means, to become aware of this truth of our being, to realize it, to make it effective here or elsewhere, is the object of all yoga. Do you guys care to discuss this? because it's very profound, you know. So like in my other Indian group, we have been talking and talking and talking about spirituality and change of consciousness. But I just want to understand, you know, like, so what does it mean? So this object of the yoga, so he says that, right? The last three lines, no matter whether by any means, to become aware of this truth of our being is the object of all yoga. I mean, does anyone have any comments to make? Like, what is this sensation of the truth of your being? So how do you relate this truth to other, like, realities? So is there something that is not truth? I mean, if this is true, what is not true? I mean, I'm asking because, like, we were talking about changing the consciousness. And so I'm just trying to relate this to that. How do you become aware? What do you call this awareness? What is this truth? How do you contrast it to something false?
If I center myself in this idea continuously, as often as I remember, it begins to be integrated in myself. It's a long process. It is not an overnight thing for any one of us, or maybe for some, I don't know. falsehood is just when we come from the ego, when we come from the little self. Not that it is always false, but it is limited. So it's just a practice of continuing to center oneself in this larger, in this vast reality, that I am that and there is nothing outside of that. And that's the practice.
Okay, so you're saying that the truthfulness is being aware of vastness. And falsehood is being limited to your ego.
Yeah, that I am not separate from that. And the nobody is. Except we forget. We all forget all the time. And that's when we get lost.
That's very succinctly put, actually.
Well, thank you. Hope that helps.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrea.
I also think we have had this discussion before, but when Sri Aurobindo says something, he's not actually saying the one thing. He's saying all of the things. And the one thing that he's saying is part of, it's an activation of the field that is the whole thing. And so you can't ever take the one passage on its own without taking it in consideration of all the rest.
So I'm asking, does this hold for all his books? Like you said that you cannot separate this one line and contrast it to other lines.
I didn't say you couldn't separate it from an analytical perspective. And you can certainly gain some insight by doing so. But you have to recognize that you're kind of missing the point when you do that. You know, there's a level at which it informs what one's thinking about, but of course that's the intellect. And the text is not speaking us only at the level of the intellect. It's speaking to us in the larger sense of the self, the soul, and everything else. It's why reading Sri Aurobindo is so interesting, because if it was just the intellectual argument, it would be interesting, but it wouldn't have the same power that these texts have.
I mean, I think I'm kind of, not that old. I'm not calling you guys old, but like I'm not as mature as you to get that difference between the intellectual plane and the higher plane. So like, my highest conception is the intellectual plane. So like for me to, I mean, I'm trying to process what you're saying, and I guess.
Yeah, well, we're all, was it brains on sticks? We all are cut off at the heads to some extent. So, you know, we live in this part of the body and not in the rest of it, all of us. It's part of the 21st century culture. We're trained to do that.
Yeah.
And the text is trying to drive us down into the rest of what's going on, down and up, right? Down into the body and up into the other planes.
Yeah. So
we're all not that far from where you are. We're just we just maybe have in some cases, you know, thought a little bit longer about some of these things. That's it.
Well, definitely. At least you have at least 10 years more on Earth of thinking and existing than I do. So that definitely counts for something.
So, Radhika,
I'm actually glad. Like, I'm glad that I'm not surrounded by 20-year-olds like who are like, I can tell they're not on the same plane as me. So, yeah.
So, Radhika, try and see if you can hear the paragraph, each paragraph, as a transmission rather than an intellectual exercise. Every paragraph Sri Aurobindo has ever written, in my perception, is a transmission into the being, into the whole being, into the body too. It is not an intellectual exercise. It's not trying to comprehend it. Just take it in. Just breathe it in. Listen, speak it. It will come. Not in your time, not in my time, but it will come in its own time.
I think you're right. It takes its own time.
It takes a long time. And that's why reading it, we continue to read Sri Aurobindo over and over and over, because every time we receive something.
Okay.
Try it.
I can also say about this, that this paragraph, this was the very, very first paragraph that I read of Sri Aurobindo. I think it's now about 30 years ago. I was in a library. That's a synthesis of yoga. Oh, appealing, because so I know everything about yoga, I thought. No? So I opened it, and the first page, the first paragraph was this. And this struck me so deeply. I said, this is true. So what is the truth? What is an absolute truth? I don't know. I can't rationalize this. I can't tell you in analytical terms this, because this is true and this is false. This simply struck me inside me something. And I said, this is so powerful. I must buy this book. And I bought The Synthesis of Yoga. But it was not the first that I read. It, just there was a trilogy of Supreme. So I bought also the trilogy of Supreme. And I don't know why I began, because at those times, in fact, I was reading these things. I said, yeah, but what does it mean? And so I was not really getting through. Not that now we are getting everything, but I think, and it took me time. And interestingly, I was asking myself, I think a couple of weeks ago, where is this paragraph? And I looked up and didn't find it. Now, today, I see just open the page and here it is. And I read the trilogy and all the other yoga books and then returned back to this. And then I saw through also more, I agree, we should not say it analytically, mentally, but there was more precise understanding. But at the first time when I read this, it was something that struck me in my heart, or maybe in a higher mind, I don't know, or both. Huh? But I would not be able to tell someone else in a rational manner what struck me so much, so powerfully. And that's from that level that we have to read it, I think.
Yeah, it definitely goes beyond rationality. I deny that.
Yeah, as Andrea said, it's not, in a certain sense, Sri Aurobindo uses a philosophical and mental language. But what he is talking about is not at all mental. But at the end, it is a mean. It appeals the intellect to go beyond the intellect. But I would not say that it is rational or mental, as many people say, even though you cannot compare it to Savitri. Savitri is, but we, as we already said the last time. So, it's something that appeals to the mind to go beyond itself. You can put it also that way, if you wish.
And what always strikes me that it seems also very logical. It's always logical, which is so satisfying.
Logic. No, so a higher mind, a over mind, a super mind, etc. I'm not sure that it excludes logic. It's, I think Mother once said that the main power of the mind is to organize things, organize ideas, organize our doing, organize also practically. And this organizational power will probably remain also once we have gone beyond the mind. I don't know. I just speculating, but
well, then of course there's the higher mind, right? So Indra is one of the great, the greatest powers to illuminate the mind. So that's part of the practice, is to allow this transmission to illuminate our minds, so the mind can rise to a higher level.
Shall I continue? Okay. Oh, I have only a little chat. But the passage is long and the labor arduous before we can look on him with eyes that see through. And still longer and more arduous must be our endeavor if we would rebuild ourselves in his true image. I read this sentence again. But the passage is long and the labor arduous before we can look on him with eyes that see through. And still longer and more arduous must be our endeavor if we would rebuild ourselves in his true image. The master of the work does not reveal himself at once to the seeker. Always it is his power that acts behind the veil. But it is manifest only when we renounce the egoism of the worker. And its direct movement increases in proportion as that renunciation becomes more and more complete. Only when our surrender to his divine Shakti is absolute shall we have the right to live in his absolute presence. And only then can we see our work through itself naturally, completely, and simply into the mold of the divine will.
There must be, therefore, by stages and gradations in our approach to this perfection, as there are in the progress towards all other perfection on any plane of nature. The vision of the full glory may come to us before, suddenly or slowly, once or often, but until the foundation is complete, it is a summary and concentrated, not a durable and all-enveloping and experience, not a lasting presence. The amplitudes, the infinite contents of the divine revelation come afterwards and unroll gradually their power and their significance. Or even the steady vision can be there on the summits of our nature, but the perfect response of the lower members comes only by degrees. In all yogas, the first requisites are faith and patience. The first requisites are faith and patience. The ardors of the heart and the violences of the eager will that seek to take the kingdom of heaven by storm can have miserable reactions if they disdain to support their vehemence on these humbler and quieter auxiliaries. And in the long and difficult integral yoga, there must be an integral faith and an unshakable patience.
it is difficult to acquire or to practice this faith and steadfastness on the rough and narrow path of yoga because of the impatience of both heart and mind and the eager but soon faltering will of our rajasic nature. The vital nature of man hungers always for the fruit of its labor. And if the fruit appears to be denied or long delayed, he loses faith in the ideal and in the guidance. For his mind judges always by the appearance of things, since that is the first ingrained habit of the intellectual reason in which he so inordinately trusts. Nothing is easier for us than to accuse God in our hearts when we suffer long or stumble in the darkness, or to abjure the ideal that we have set before us. For we say, I have trusted to the highest, and I am betrayed into suffering and sin and error. Or else, I have staked my whole life on an idea which the stern facts of experience contradict and discourage. It would have been better to be as other men who, as other men are, who accept their limitations and walk on the firm ground of normal experience. In such moments, and they are sometimes frequent and long, all the higher experience is forgotten, and the heart concentrates itself on its own bitterness. It is in these dark passages that it is possible to fall for good or to turn back from the divine labor.
If one has walked long and steadily in the path, the faith of the heart will remain under the fiercest adverse pressure, even if it is concealed or apparently overborne. It will take the first opportunity to reemerge. For something higher than either heart or intellect upholds it, in spite of the worst stumblings and through the most prolonged failure. But even to the experienced sadhaka, such falterings or overcloudings bring a retardation of his progress, and they are exceedingly dangerous to the novice. It is therefore necessary from the beginning to understand and accept the arduous difficulty of the path and to feel the need of a faith to which the intellect may seem blind, but yet is wiser than our reasoning intelligence. For this faith is a support from above. It is the brilliant shadow thrown by a secret light that exceeds the intellect and its data. It is the heart of a hidden knowledge that is not at the mercy of immediate appearances. Our faith, persevering, will be justified in its works and will be lifted and transfigured at last into the self-revelation of a divine knowledge. Always we must adhere to the injunction of the Gita. Yoga must be continually applied with a heart free from despondent sinking. Always we must repeat to the doubting intellect the promise of the Master. I will surely deliver thee from all sin and evil. Do not grieve. At the end, the flickerings of faith will cease, for we shall see his face and feel always the divine presence.
Sorry, I was muted. The master of our works respects our nature even when he is transforming it. He works always through the nature and not by any arbitrary caprice. This imperfect nature of ours contains the materials of our perfection, but inchoate, distorted, misplaced, thrown together in disorder or a poor, imperfect order. All this material has to be patiently perfected, purified, reorganized, new molded and transformed, not hacked and hewn and slain or mutilated, not obliterated by simple coercion and denial. This world and we who live in it are his creation and manifestation. And he deals with it and us in a way our narrow and ignorant mind cannot understand, unless it falls silent and opens to a divine knowledge. In our errors is the substance of a truth which labors to reveal its meaning to our groping intelligence. The human intellect cuts out the error and the truth with it and replaces it by another half-truth, half-error. But the divine wisdom suffers our mistakes to continue until we are able to arrive at the truth hidden and protected under every false cover. Our sins are the misdirected steps of a seeking power that aims not at sin but at perfection, at something that we might call a divine virtue. Often they are the veils of a quality that has to be transformed and delivered out of this ugly disguise. Otherwise, in the perfect providence of things, they would not have been suffered to exist or to continue. The master of our works is neither a blunderer nor an indifferent witness, nor a dallier with the luxury of unneeded evils. He is in our virtue.
Our nature...
Marco, before going on, I just wanted to, because we there was a kind of break between the last two, between the second previous paragraph and the previous paragraph, and I had wanted to break to discuss, and we sort of gone straight through. I did want to go back to, so at the top of page 244, it is a summary and concentrated, not a durable and all-enveloping experience, not a lasting presence. The amplitudes, the infinite contents of the divine revelation come afterwards and unroll gradually their power and significance. Or even the steady vision can be there on the summits of our nature, but the perfect response of the lower members comes only by degrees. In all yoga, the first requisites are faith and patience. So I think that's, it's maybe related to the discussion we had a little bit earlier, but patience seems to me one of those virtues that is undervalued somehow, that we tend to sort of, we ourselves tend to race over it when we should slow down and recognize the role of patience. Anyway, that whole passage seemed to me to be, and also this idea of a summary and concentrated as opposed to the durable experience, that the which is more this sort of the summary and concentrated is what speaks to the intellect, but it's the durable in all enveloping experience that speaks to the deeper self, right? So anyway, just some thoughts about that passage.
Yeah, I also, like, there was something that I, it reminded me of me, like, so where he says, the ardors of the heart and the violences of the eager will that seek to take the kingdom of heaven by storm. I mean, that's kind of, it reminds me of me, because, you know, I was like, I'm going to read the synthesis of yoga in like a few months.
But I had that experience too, the first year I was there in Pondicherry, and I had seen Mother and went to Oroville. I was on fire. I was going to do the intro yoga within a year. And then one day I saw Mother and she threw her head back in laughter because she saw my upheaval. I think that's how I understand that.
You met her?
Yes.
When was this?
1972.
Oh, that was just before she passed away.
Yeah, I got there just in time. Yeah. So another reflection on patience. Patience is such a wonderful thing. And I, for me, being patient with myself is an act of great kindness. I just wanted to put that in the field. Because I always need to be, think that I should be better or perfect or get it already. And no, I don't.
When you met Mother, like, so I'm just curious because I have not met her, obviously. I mean, So did she look different, or like, did she look in any way non-human? I mean, did she have, was there anything about her that seemed?
Well, the thing that happened, which is interesting that you just say this, was she non-human? When I was in front of her and looked in her eyes, it was a long time, it seemed nothing happening. There was just this profound silence. And then all of a sudden, I heard my own voice saying in my own mind, open up. And in that moment, we recognized one another. We were both ecstatic in the recognition of seeing one another. And there was no, she is this divine mother and I am this poor thing. We were in that moment, we were the same. And this is, we are all that. She was more conscious of that than I ever was or ever will be, probably. But in that moment, I was in that experience where we were actually the same and recognized one another. It was a transcendental experience. And I wept for 3 days. Anyway, that's enough about my story. We'll have some more story some other time. Thanks for asking.
Andrea told her story in a recent issue of Collaboration. This is spring of 2019.
Okay. Our nature is not only mistaken in will and ignorant in knowledge, but weak in power. But the divine force is there and will lead us if we trust in it, and it will use our deficiencies and will lead us if we trust in it. Our nature is not only mistaken in will and ignorant in knowledge, but weak in power. But the divine force is there and will lead us if we trust in it, and it will use our deficiencies and our powers for the divine purpose. If we fail in our immediate aim, it is because he has intended the failure. Often our failure or ill result is the right road to a truer issue that an immediate and complete success would have put in our reach. If we suffer, it is because something in us has to pretend to be prepared for a rare possibility of delight. If we stumble, it is to learn in the end the secret of a more perfect walking. Let us not be in too furious a haste to acquire even peace, purity, and perfection. Peace must be ours, but not the peace of an empty or devastated nature, or of slain or mutilated capacities incapable of unrest because we have made them incapable of intensity and fire and force. Purity must be our aim, but not the purity of a void or of a bleak and rigid coldness. Perfection is demanded of us, but not the perfection that can exist only by confining its scope within narrow limits or putting an arbitrary full stop to the ever self-extending scroll of the infinite. Our object is to change into the divine nature. But the divine nature is not a mental, moral, but a spiritual condition, difficult to achieve, difficult even to conceive by our intelligence. The master of our work and our yoga knows the thing to be done, and we must allow him to do it in us by his own means and in his own manner.
The movement of the ignorance is egoistic at its core And nothing is more difficult for us than to get rid of egoism while yet we admit personality and adhere to action in the half light and half force of our unfinished nature. Oh, I love that line. The movement of the ignorance is egoistic at its core, and nothing is more difficult for us than to get rid of egoism while yet we admit personality and adhere to action in the half light and half force of our unfinished nature. It is easier to starve the ego by renouncing the impulse to act or to kill it by cutting away from us all movement and personality. It is easier to exalt it into self-forgetfulness, immersed in a trance of peace or an ecstasy of divine love. But our more difficult problem is to liberate the true person and attain to a divine manhood, personhood, which shall be the pure vessel of a divine force and the perfect instrument of a divine action. Step after step has to be firmly taken. Difficulty after difficulty has to be entirely experienced and entirely mastered. Only divine wisdom and power can do this for us. And it will do all if we yield to it in an entire faith and follow and assent to its workings with a constant courage and patience.
Can I interject? There was something that I wanted to dwell on. So he talks about ego, the action of the egoistic being, and he also talks about personality. So he says that first line, the movement of the ignorance is egoistic at its core, and nothing is more difficult for us than to get rid of egoism, while yet we admit personality and adhere to action in the half light and half force of our unfinished nature. So personality is not synonymous with egoism. And I thought it was.
But each one of us is unique. You are a unique manifestation of the divine. And your personality is the unique manifestation of the divine.
So the personality is like a diminution, right? Like
No. It just, he tries to suggest to get it separated from the ego, to allow your uniqueness to express itself in the half light and the half force of our partially finished nature. To appreciate.
I also think there's kind of an argument against the sort of, I mean, he does this elsewhere in Synthesis of Yoga. He talks about the fact that those yogis who isolate themselves in order to develop their spiritual being, it's a valuable approach, but it's not the integral approach in the complete way. And here, he's sort of arguing that there's no simple path to this. You can't just shut off the ego and the personality and get to the spiritual level by doing that. You have to. It's more a path of acceptance and abandon than it is a path of rejection and abandon. One has to accept the self in order to move forward, not reject all these, you know. I think that my point is clear.
I think we will get more precise instructions about that at page 577, where Sri Aurobindo speaks of the divine personality. So once we have the contrast and we can compare the human, the egoistic personality with the divine personality, maybe. But, well, 577 is... If you are patient enough, you have, you can exercise it, and there you will get the whole answer from Sri Aurobindo himself, I suppose. But just to point out that there is also a divine personality. So personality is not only something that has necessarily a negative connotation.
I think the ego is this idea of, well, it's not only the idea of attachment, but it's partly the idea of attachment. So you know, we get attached to things, and we have this part of ourselves that thinks it's the center of the world and then the only thing going on. And that's the stuff that we have to move away from. But that doesn't mean to say that we give up our whole personality in doing so. I think that's the point.
But your personality is the way you react to things, right? It includes the way you react. And the way you react is connected to your egoistic perception of everything around you.
No, I think the personality is essentially a set of preferences about the world, values and preferences, not necessarily reactions. Reactions can be very... I don't know, instinctual, which is a different thing. I don't know.
Maybe it helps to see it more as your true nature rather than how you react. In the beginning, that is all mixed up together because we react from ignorance and from past experiences. But the more that calms down, the more your true nature can shine forward.
I mean, I think of it as a set of qualities. So your personality, so if there's an infinite set of qualities, your personality is going to accentuate certain qualities at the cost of other qualities, right? So that's your particular diminution of the infinite set of personalities. But this is very close to being egoistic, right? So if you are somebody who's more intense than peaceful, that gives your ego a certain turn, right? So your personality is intimately related to your egoistic perception. Your perception of the world is necessarily egoistic if you are a human being, a normal human being.
The ego,
maybe I've thought about this too much.
The ego is basically the experience of separation. So the ego means I'm me and I'm not you. I'm not anything else. And all the other things that result from that, like attachment, are a result of feeling separate. If I'm separate from food, you know, I need to have food. If I'm separate from beauty, I need to have all these needs and these attachments. And also, if I'm separate, other things can threaten me. So it means a sense of being separate. And of course, the other pole of that is unity, which is what we're seeking. But the personality is not about separation. It's about a certain selection of qualities that your soul chose to experience in a world not of unity, but of a world, our world, you know, our world of manifestation that's imperfect. So the sense of separation and the sense of personality can blend together, like Andrea was saying, but separation is the essence of ego, the belief, the belief that I'm myself, I'm not you, I'm not anything else. And we can cloud that around with the qualities of my particular personality versus someone else's particular personality. But it's not the same thing.
Brilliantly said, John Robert.
Yeah, that was very clear, actually. I like that explanation.
You know, there's one interesting thing one of the things that Sri Aurobindo said in The Life Divine, which was a big kind of an aha for me. In The Life Divine, he says that the divine is absolute power and absolute freedom. And that includes the freedom to self-limit. The freedom to self and the power to self-limit. So we think of the divine as all and everything and the one and all that. And it has all these qualities, one of which is the power to self-limit. So we are the result and everything that we see in this, in our material world, in our evolutionary world here, is a result of that power. It's the self-limitation of the divine. And behind that, it's still the divine, and so it's still all. But it's a play in this world of a particular selection. That's your personality, that particular selection. If we take the limitation that the divine puts on itself as in our experience rather absolute, you know, I'm separate, I'm limited, that's where that slides over into ego. So, you know, Sri Aurobindo said the ego is a helper, the ego is the bar. So he's not saying the ego is bad. He said the ego is a helper. It's been the helper in order to help us form an individuality. And then at a certain point, it becomes the bar for us to experience the fullness of that individuality, which includes the all.
Yeah, it's very poetic, actually, like this limitation and then this sense of the all. Yeah.
Yeah, as I was listening to this part of the synthesis, I kept seeing Sri Aurobindo's poetic genius coming in. Even though he's not writing, this is not poetry, he can't help himself. He's a poet.
It's his personality. Again. It's also part of his personality. I think Sri Aurobindo and Madhava were, in a certain sense, they were one and yet very two different personalities. He expressed himself, for example, he expressed himself a lot through writings. Madhava did not left us much writings, apart from the prayers and meditations. But that's also something that expresses a particular personality. So it would be a boring world if we would have, after realization, having become realized yogis, and then being everyone equal with the same personality. This is exactly the contrary of the unity in diversity. The divine unity is a unity in diversity. And also diverse personalities. Sorry,
as we need to play. We need
John
personality
Robert?
To play.
It's a play.
Yeah. I was just saying, Mother's personality, right, in contrast to Sri Aurobindo's, that used to like weigh heavily with me when I had, like, some years ago, because I felt myself very close to Sri Aurobindo. But I always was afraid of Mother, because I saw her as this woman who set up, you know, a city. Auroville is a city, right? Like, or it's like it's going to be a city. So this woman who came to a foreign country and she ran an ashram with people she did not even know, and she set up a school and she set up a city. And so just that kind of personality is intimidating. Whereas like Aurobindo, he wrote all these beautiful poems, and so like I felt attracted to him, but I was like, who is this lady?
So the magic of Mother was that everything she did, all this that looks can easily look like control or domination,
exactly, control and domination, that's what strikes me about Mother.
It was all done in utter sweetness. She was sweet beyond comprehension. Every direction that she gave was given with utter sweetness. If you just read the words, we interpret it as, oh my God. But she does embody the power of the divine. She's the Shakti. The Shakti is the power of the divine, which is feminine. But it is exercised in utter sweetness, in infinite love, and kindness. You would have never seen such sweetness as in her. And it sounds contradictory, but it is really true.
Yeah, because I just thought that, you know, this very powerful lady, I mean, like, I just imagine that she's, like, it's hard to think of her as being sweet, right? I mean, if you are meeting prime ministers and politicians, and if you have, like, hundreds of people coming to you every day, I mean, like, are you going to be sweet to all of them?
But you see, she was free of her ego. She was completely identified with the divine. And so when you said, here she was running this thing with all these people she didn't know. In fact, the personal experience of everyone I've ever spoken with who met Mother was this feeling that she knew you. She knew you better than you knew yourself. She had that capacity to see all the way into your soul, because she was not separate. She was not separate from you.
So the funny thing is, my maternal grandmother, who was like a village woman, like she was not that educated, she met Mother in the 70s. And I wasn't there, obviously, I wasn't born. But she told my mom that she was scared, like that she felt intimidated. But you have to understand, like she came from a practically uneducated background, but she was very devoted to the Shakti. Like she used to do the traditional Shakti pujas, so maybe that's why she was granted the darshan. You know, you not everybody gets the darshan of. That's what we say in India. To get the darshan of these personalities is like the result of your previous good karma. So she got the darshan. But then apparently she told my mom, I've never been so scared in my life.
I'm sorry she was so scared.
So my grandmother said that Mother like bored into her eyes. So she kept looking and looking and looking into her eyes so much that my grandmother got like completely scared.
She did all kinds. She gave you what you needed, even if you didn't understand it.
Interesting.
Shall I read on? The first step on this long path, is that where we're at?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. The first step on this long path is to consecrate all our works as a sacrifice to the divine in us and in the world. I'm going to say that again. The first step on this long path is to consecrate all our works as a sacrifice to the divine in us and in the world. This is an attitude of the mind and heart, not too difficult to initiate, but very difficult to make absolutely sincere and all-pervasive. The second step is to renounce attachment to the fruit of our works, for the only true, inevitable, and utterly desirable fruit of sacrifice, the one thing needful, is the divine presence and the divine consciousness and power in us. And if that is gained, all else will be added. This is a transformation of the egoistic will in our vital being, our desire soul and desire nature. And it is far more difficult than the other. The third step is to get rid of the central egoism and even the ego sense of the worker. That is the most difficult transformation of all, and it cannot be perfectly done if the first two steps have not been taken. But these first two steps cannot be completed unless the third comes in to crown the movement, and by the extinction of egoism, eradicates the very origin of desire. Only when the small ego sense is rooted out from the nature can the seeker know his true person that stands out above as a portion and power of the divine and renounce all motive force other than the will of the divine Shakti. That's a big one.
Should I continue? Or
so there's a break here, and I know we just talked, but I wondered if anybody wanted to say anything before I go on.
Well, I maybe I need to reread that paragraph because I got lost between the first, second, and third steps.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeffrey Jen.
The first step on this long path is to concentrate all our works as a sacrifice to the divine in us and in the world. This is an attitude of the mind and heart, not too difficult to initiate, but very difficult to make absolutely sincere and all-pervasive. The second, so I get the first step. I maybe not master it, but I get it. The second step is to renounce attachment to the fruit of our works. For the only true, inevitable, and utterly desirable fruit of sacrifice, the one thing needful, is the divine presence and the divine consciousness and power in us. And if that is gained, all else will be added. So I get the principle of that. This is a transformation of the egoistic will in our vital being, our desire soul and desire nature, and it is far more difficult than the other.
One question. What does he mean by other? Like the
yes, that's what I'm struggling with. I think he means the first step, which is the consecrating of our works to the divine. So the transformation of the egoistic will is harder than consecrating all our being to the divine. That's the way I read that, but I'm not sure.
Yes, it's the detachment from the fruit of our labor, to be detached of the outcome.
Yeah, I must admit I have problems with that one. So, I mean,
of course. That's only natural, darling.
The third step is to get rid of the central egoism. So what does he mean by central egoism? And even the ego sense of the worker. And again, I'm not sure what that means.
Well, we tend to be so identified with being the doer, right? It's very difficult to step out of that perception that I am not the doer.
Except that many people, especially artists, have that experience. Of doing writing a poem or doing a painting or singing. I mean, playing music, there are times when you're being done too. I mean, you're being played when you're playing music sometimes, or when you're singing sometimes in a group. So the separate ego disappears, and it just is all happening, and it happens to be happening partly through you.
But that's a good thing, right? Like the fact that the playing is done to you is a good thing, right?
Well, it's what he's talking about here. It's not the complete completely getting rid of the central egoism, but it's an experience of being beyond egoism. And I think probably all of us here have had that in one way or another. But then, you know, we fall back into it. So it's me talking now, not you, not anybody else. I had a teacher who used to say, when she was giving a talk, she would say, I happen to be talking here, but we're all listening to the same thing.
Sometimes someone can also perceive this ego as something veiled that comes up when something goes wrong. The feeling that makes me angry when I don't, I'm not able to do something and I don't have the result that I, with my mind, I projected and imagined to have. For example, nowadays, making functioning microphone of my, and something at some moment I got angry and said, why does this thing not work as it should? And I said, well, getting upset for such a stupid thing that I, in fact, I don't even need because I have this microphone here. She said, what's that? What is it? It's a theater and of someone or something in us that is attached to the result. And you can see it in these moments, perhaps even better in the negative sense.
So what is the difference between two and three? Because they're both detached.
Well, two is the renouncing of the fruit, but it doesn't. You can still think you're the one that's doing it,
yeah.
Even though the result, you say, okay, well, I give that to the divine. I don't claim anything in the result, but there might be still a separate sense that's doing the not claiming.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
I want to just mention something.
So if you don't want the fruit, and you're not even saying, you're not even the one that's doing the not claiming, so what's left? Like, I don't get that.
What was that? Would
you the divine that? Is left.
So you're not claiming the fruit, so you have renounced the fruit. And you're also saying, look, I'm not even doing the one that is not claiming the fruit. So what is left? Like, what's you? Where is the you? Where is the I?
It's all that. The divine is the whole show, including you. And you are then one with that if you get to that place or in those moments. You lose your separation.
Can we not relate these things also to our everyday experience without this, without needing it to relate it to some still for us abstract higher experience? Sometimes, doesn't it happen that we work hard for something? It doesn't, we don't get the fruit as we wished, but we say, okay, doesn't matter. The work to do it was nice, even if I did not get the result. Yeah. And in these moments, I feel much better than the moment where I said, oh, I had this result and this. It's me, I was doing that work and I have done well. But if I say, okay, I've done a lot of work, but it didn't work out as I expected. And I don't react selfishly and say, oh, and don't get depressed for this neither. I say, okay, and accept it completely, then I feel much better. What is it?
Yeah, so I was doing something similar. I was thinking about, so you'll laugh when you hear what I'm going to say, maybe. But I write novels. So consecrating the work of writing the novels to the divine, I think that's something that I can get myself around, kind of. Obviously, doing it all the way, as you say, is maybe hard. But initial impulse is there. Letting go of the fruit. Now, the first time I read that, I thought, oh, does that mean I don't get to publish? I have to abandon the idea of publishing? But that's not what it's saying. It's actually saying you go ahead and do what you need to do, whatever you, and you don't get hung up on how it gets reacted to, you know, in terms of, you know, do I get recognition? Maybe that doesn't really matter all that much. Do I get money? Maybe that's not all that, you know, I pull myself back from those kinds of attachments to the process of publishing. And then the third one is the one that John Robert was talking about. And it's true that as a writer, you have this sense that you're not doing the writing. You have this sense that something is writing through you. But it's hard to maintain all the time as a sense of what's going on. You know, one goes around feeling puffed up with pride about, oh, that piece was a really good piece that I wrote there. And detaching those kinds of, you know, because they're pleasure. So it's hard to detach oneself from the pleasures. The pains are easy to detach oneself from, but the pleasures are not so easy to attach oneself.
But the pleasure can also be offered. The pleasure is marvelous. The pleasure is the joy of being, right? The joy of the creation. You can offer that too. It all becomes part of the sacrifice, which is not about suffering or denying yourself any kind of joy. It's just to keep it spacious.
Anyway, it was just a kind of thinking through that I was doing about this passage.
So before we go on, I wanted to bring up something. Seems like to me there was in this group that we've talked about, whether Sri Aurobindo and the mother deal with the shadow or not, or deal with shadow work. And some people said not so much. And I was noticing, especially the first paragraph in this section, starts on page 245, the master of our work respects our nature. And that whole paragraph, I kept getting the feeling that he was talking about shadow work, that the master of the work, in a sense, participates in our shadow work. This is on the next page. In our errors is the substance of a truth, which labors to reveal its meaning to our groping intelligence. So that's one of the ideas in shadow work. In shadow work, there's something that's been disowned by the person, but actually has value. It's been turned dark by the disowning of the person, whether the disowning was conscious or unconscious. And so it's split off from the person's access. And it's like one is kind of limping along because this part of oneself has been disowned. It's in the shadows, considered bad. But he says, in our errors is the substance of a truth. So it's like he's recognizing that the value in the disowned parts of ourselves. And often they are the veils of a quality that has to be transformed and delivered out of this ugly disguise. That's also in the same paragraph. I thought it was interesting that it seems like he's talking about trauma work here.
Sorry, I don't get this. What is this shadow work? Maybe you discussed it before I joined.
Shadow is usually a psychological term, and it refers to the part of ourselves that we don't acknowledge. So maybe there are parts of my past or my personality that I'm ashamed of. And so I disown it. I think it's bad. I don't want anybody to see it. I don't want to see it myself. If it comes up in front of me, I go like that and make it go away faster than I even know. That's the shadow. It's kind of it's like the sun is shining in this part of me, and this is a part I like, and this is a part I project forward to everybody, so they'll like me too. But the part, then the sun hits, and then behind me there's this other part that I'd just rather nobody see. I don't want anybody to see this part. And so the personality works in various ways, unconsciously or consciously or a mixture, to make sure that doesn't come out in public. You know, it's my dirty laundry. I don't want my dirty laundry out in public. But Sri Aurobindo here is talking about the master recognizes that in our errors is the substance of a truth. And that's the same way that psychologists will work with somebody on their shadow part. Does that help, Radhika?
Yeah, thank you, John Robert. Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, I think everybody has this shadow, like all people do.
Yes, we all have shadows.
Yeah, I mean, we have them. And the more that we can bring what's behind out in the light, especially to ourselves, or maybe with somebody's help, often another person is a big help. You know, a dear friend who will say something like, you know, that part back there, actually, there's really a value hidden in that part of your being that you're not acknowledging there. What he seems to be saying here, that recognizing those shadow parts in this paragraph and acknowledging that, bringing them forward, is part of the work of the master of our being.
I think the argument that we have ongoing about this subject is not that Sri Aurobindo and the mother don't deal with shadow. They do, and it's rife. It's all the way through their work. The issue is that trauma has its own particularities that are not easy to deal with in even a standard shadow way of looking at things. Trauma, shadow, you can look at ordinary shadow. You know, the parts that we don't want to look at for all sorts of reasons, we can look at and gain progress on. But trauma, just looking at it, can be shattering to a person. And so there are other ways that have to be used to deal with trauma. You can't just bring it up to the light and expect the work to be done. That there are survival issues related to dealing with trauma, and they're not easy to deal with. And so, and that part of the discussion, because it's work that's been done since Sri Aurobindo was writing these works. So that part of the discussion is not present in his writings. He wasn't part of the general awareness at that time, but it is present now. And so, there's a need to sort of, I think there's a need to sort of examine the arguments that Sri Aurobindo and the mother make and find ways to integrate the more recent understanding of trauma into those discussions. That's my understanding of the argument, if you like.
I think it's my turn. Shall we go on? Or
yep.
Is that, we've been going for an hour and 20, almost an hour and 20 minutes now.
Yeah. How are we doing for time? I think, aren't we usually just reading about an hour?
Well, we're over an hour so far.
Right.
18 past.
I feel quite full with everything. Wonderful session. I wouldn't mind to stop it here.
And we're I don't know if we're halfway through the chapter, but we've got a long way to go. So it's not, you know, it's not that if we cover a bit more, we're going to get close to the end. It's not going to happen.
you're going to get enlightened.
Yeah, there is quite a bit to go in this chapter.
And Andrea, thank you for talking about mother's personality. Like, I was always curious. I just thought of her as this dominating personality.
Yeah. If you like, you and I could do a private little FaceTime or Zoom session together.
Yeah, after my semester gets over, I would like to, talk to you. Yeah. I have your email. I'll write to you.
Yes.
So at one time, I had built up all these reservations about mother. It was just weird. I just kept thinking of her as maybe a punishing goddess.
That's the old, I would call it the Christian perception.
Oh, okay.
But we all have the fear, we all have fear of power.
Yeah, yeah. She comes across in her actions, all the things she did in her life. Those are not things a normal person does. So that when you think of that, it's kind of intimidating. I'll write to you later on. I'm in the middle of my semester.
Yeah.
So, but you're not the only one who has issues about the mother either. In my case, it's a different reason, but there are issues for me that have to do with the fact that my mother was a very invasive person. And so I tend to assume that the mother is invasive too, because as part of the general expression of that. And I have issues about that too. So,
none of us was there, right? Like, except Andrea, I don't think anyone has met her or anything like that.
Did you hear the recordings of her? The audio recordings?
Of mother, yeah.
Yeah. And
her voice is awful.
Yes. But they give you this sense of fear of a dominating personality that instills fear?
It depends what you're listening to. When she reads Sri Aurobindo or reads something like that, she is like this powerful actress that is trying to pour down the power of the text. But if you listen to when she speaks to a person, there's this
sweetness.
Incredible softness.
Yeah.
That like nothing else. It's there. She has all these channels. She's Kali too, She's Lakshmi and Kali and all of them. All the aspects of the Divine Mother she embodies when appropriate.
Naturally, I had the opposite experience. When I read her about her, I had also this. Also, this must be someone very with a strong character, and that it dumps you down when you say something. But when I heard the recordings, then I saw humility, an absolute perfect humility, no ego sense, and sweetness, as you say, also, Andrea. And this transpires through a recording. And the tone is, that you can see that, perceive that power and sweetness are not opposites, are not contradictory, quite the contrary. And that's a problem that we have in modern society, I think. We always think that power is something of the demons. We don't conceive that power can be something also divine. And in Mother, I perceive power, but also something very, very calming, relaxing, not something that instills me fear or any. But okay, that's, again, a matter of personality.
Which recording did you listen to of Mother's? Like you said,
I don't know, lots and lots. If you just go on YouTube or the recordings of the agenda a little bit, because most of the agenda are in French.
Yeah, it's in French.
Yeah, but there's also some in English. Yeah, you can. And if you go on YouTube and Mother Sri Aurobindo, Mother Aurobindo, you have to put as keywords.
No, I have. I listened to her reciting the book, The Mother, and that sounded kind of powerful to me.
Yeah, when she reads, but when she says something of her own without reading, that's perhaps because when she reads, I think she is trying to channel in Sri Aurobindo or another power. And also the gesture. Right? Do you see the films? She walks into, I would say, oh, this is a little person. I would, does not instill me in any way any fear. And you, for me, it's a divine power that is veiled, because otherwise, if it comes through all at once, it would crush us, I think. And that some people have these experiences, not only with mother, but also with other realized masters. When you look them in the eyes, you get into contact with such a vastness, with a universe, with a cosmic consciousness, that our ordinary human consciousness can overwhelm us, and can be interpreted by our vital or whatever as in terms of fear. But it's just the infinity. Yeah.
Shall we meditate for a few moments?
Thank you all. That was lovely.
Yes, beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
It's lovely to have you with us, Radhika.
Yeah.
I'm also enjoying it.
Good.
I like it.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.